You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the United States has one of the highest rates of maternal death in the developed world. We'll find out why and look at what a growing number of hospitals are doing to keep women safe during childbirth. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we talked to Jeremy Ryan. He's running as a Republican for Wisconsin's first congressional district seat, which includes Janesville. Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the basic 30-second pitch. What do you tell people about why you're running?
I'm running because I think radical change requires someone radically different. I think that the system is so horribly messed up, and I think both parties are so horribly messed up that you need someone from outside of that, and that you need someone who's not playing a money game whatsoever. I'm spending less than $5,000 the entire campaign and self-funding the whole thing myself. Both parties hate me, and I'm certainly the most unconventional candidate in this race and probably any statewide race right now.
And what are some of your key issues that you're bringing to the public's attention here?
My main platform is legalize cannabis, save billions upon billions in prison and useless enforcement efforts. And then you can possibly spend all that money on actual dangerous drugs like heroin instead. And all of the money in prison savings. Ending Citizens United, taking money out of politics, making it so that corporations and special interests don't have the ability to spend more and have more influence than the average person. Shifting tax breaks from small and from giant corporations to small and medium-sized businesses. There's no reason why GE, who's right, they just moved, I think, hundreds of jobs right outside of our district. There were several people in our district that lost their job from that, and they've paid $0 in corporate taxes for the last 10 years. There's no need why they should get those tax breaks. Instead, shift all those tax breaks to small and medium-sized businesses, family farms, Main Street communities. I am in support of tariffs, but I'm not in support of how they're being done now. I think we need to impose tariffs clear across the board, bring value to the American workers, start penalizing companies that move jobs overseas that way. And last but not least, making it so that nobody who's convicted of a nonviolent victimless crime can lose any civil rights or be housed in any federal prison.
And can you talk about your background a little bit and why you feel it makes you suited to represent the people of the First District?
I've been a political activist, primarily in constitutional rights. I started the civil disobedience at the Wisconsin State Capitol back in 2011. And a lot of that, we did actually win court cases on that. And a lot of that had to do with police issuing unconstitutional orders and protecting the First and Fourth Amendment rights in the Capitol. That was before Occupy and all those movements, so it was one of those things that really took some initiative, and people were very resistant on all levels at first. It wasn't like it is now. I ran a political action committee defending Wisconsin Political Action Committee until I got shafted by the Democratic Party. We were supposed to be in charge of ground operations for the recall, on top of that, you know, I've just been pretty well known in the community for a while.
So you said neither party is a fan of yours, but you were working on the recall. You were protesting Act 10. How do you make the case for running as a Republican in this primary?
You know, I think, well, first off, Act 10 was a state issue, and this is a federal office. I think that what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to run as a progressive Republican. And Act 10 was a rather divisive issue at the time. My campaign now isn't focused on divisive issues. Part of the problem with the country is both parties want to push you into this corner of what divides you, where most people actually agree on a lot of different things. So this campaign isn't anywhere near as divisive as my activism. It's more or less focusing on where we agree, and we can bicker about the rest later. So it's a lot different than the activism that I did in 2011. I do believe that unions are an essential check to corporations' balance, but I also believe that as far as progressive politics go, it can transcend both sides. And really the only way to crush the two-party system is to have progressives in Republican seats or conservatives in Democratic seats. That's the most feasible way to do it. And so I'm trying to lay out a blueprint for how that can be done.
Whoever ultimately wins in November will be taking over for Paul Ryan, House Speaker, been representing the district for close to 20 years. How do you evaluate his term there? How would you distinguish yourself from him?
I think he's been horrible. Paul Ryan represents the big money system, and he always has. He's one of the biggest fundraisers for the entire GOP. Paul Ryan is the system. He created the system, and he's the biggest player in it currently. I mean, no member of Congress is raising the money that he's raising. And so I would distinguish myself from the money. Paul Ryan does whatever he's told by his handlers. I don't have any handlers. I'm not taking in any money. I'm not getting paid anything. So what I would be more worried about is what the constituents have to say. And if I was elected, I would hire people to be in my staff that disagree with me, too, so that every constituent has someone in my office they can talk to, not just people who are going to agree with me or who feel exactly the way I feel. And, you know, if I'm not taking a bunch of fancy dinners with lobbyists and getting 300 bottles of champagne paid for by lobbyists, I might buy one myself here and there, but paid for by lobbyists, then I'll have plenty of time to have dinners with constituents instead.
Talking to Jeremy Ryan about his campaign for Wisconsin's first congressional district. He's running in the Republican primary. Now, we saw in your campaign filings, you have a Madison address listed, not in the first congressional district. Do you live there now? Would you live there if elected?
Yeah, if elected, I would live there. The way congressional races work, it's by federal law. And federal law just states that you have to be a resident by inauguration. And Wisconsin has a 30-day residency. So if I were to happen to win the election, then I would have about approximately 30 days to get an address and establish residency in the district, and then the other 30 days to actually make that residency legally established. And then by inauguration, I'd be able to be legally sworn in.
I want to get your take on another issue or two. You mentioned tariffs, marijuana, a couple other things. I wanted to ask about immigration. If you were in Congress, what kind of priorities would you have on immigration issues?
The way I see it with immigration is that I have a very simple immigration policy. The people who are here, I think they should be allowed to be here, be allowed to legally contribute without any repercussions, without any fears. As long as they're not committing crimes, they should be able to be legally here. And I think statistically it shows it's only a very, very, very small percentage of immigrants that are committing crimes. And then we should have a path to citizenship that's not based on some senseless test, that's not based on tens of thousands of dollars in attorney fees. It's based off of their contributions to society. So maybe every 5, 10, 15 years, we relook at it and look at what they've contributed and consider a citizenship after that.
And then the issue of health care. Paul Ryan and others in the Republican Party have been trying to repeal pieces of or all of the Affordable Care Act. What would you want to do on health care issues?
My biggest plan on healthcare is to cap the profits that insurance companies make. I have metastatic brain cancer and a congenital heart condition, and I've seen the astronomical amounts of money that treatments cost on all aspects of the healthcare system. We need to cap the profits that they can make off of everything. But when it comes to the Affordable Care Act failed on a basis of logic before, but the system before was failing too. But the reason why it failed was its logic. If I burn down your house, and you know I burned down your house, but I'm not getting charged for it, and then I offer you to pay me money to rebuild your house, how much sense would that make? What the Affordable Care Act did, it did some good things like ending pre-existing condition, lifetime caps, keeping kids on until they're 26, their parents' policy. But what the bulk of it was a massive handout to the exact people who created the problem, expecting them to fix it. And that doesn't ever work in any industry.
As we start to wrap up, make the case to Republican voters or voters who vote on that side of the aisle next week why they should vote for you.
I think I'm the only candidate that is focusing more on where we agree. I'm also the only candidate that you don't have to wonder if they're paying more attention to the money than they are to you, because I'm not taking any money. And I am indisputably different. If you're tired of what's going on in Congress, then you need something different. And I'm the type of person that can reach across the aisle and when needed, tick off both sides of the aisle. I've always been very aggressive, and I always will be, but that's what we need right now.
We'll leave it there. Jeremy Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jeremy Ryan. He's running as a Republican for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville. Farmer Kevin Adam Steen, a Republican candidate in that race, joins us this time tomorrow. Between now and the August 14th primary, candidates who are running in contested primaries are joining us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all the interviews at wisconsinvote.org. First, women in the United States suffer complications from pregnancy and childbirth at a much higher rate than in other developed countries. And some of those complications can be deadly. A new investigation finds that despite effective safety measures being well understood in the medical field, many hospitals aren't using them. California has adopted standard practices that have reduced maternal deaths, but the rest of the country has been slow to get on board. Allison Young is an investigative reporter for USA Today, writing about health, environment, and consumer issues. She recently reported on this, and Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talked with her earlier today.
Can you please give us a sense of the problem and the scope of the problem of maternal death and injury in the United States?
So one of the things that may be surprising to people is that despite the United States being one of the wealthiest countries in the world and having one of the most expensive healthcare systems, we have the highest rate of maternal deaths. These are women dying from pregnancy and childbirth-related conditions. One of the highest rates of maternal deaths in the developed world, and that's a pretty shocking thing. And we're talking about 700 women a year, approximately, die for childbirth-related reasons. But here's the even more staggering number. 50,000 women a year suffer very serious life-threatening complications related to childbirth. These are women who have to undergo transfusions. They end up in ICUs. They're put on ventilators. They suffer strokes. They may have to have hysterectomies and are no longer able to have children. 50,000 women a year are having these kinds of things happening to them. And one of the things that we're reporting is that the best estimates out there from when scientists have studied these women dying is about half of those deaths are potentially preventable with better care. And for those women who are surviving and suffering these very serious harms, as many as half of them could have had their injuries lessened or potentially prevented with better medical care.
I want to go back to something you said, that the U.S. has the worst rate among developed countries. What can we attribute that to? I mean, that just seems so shocking.
So one of the things that has been out there for quite a while is as the death rate among women has been going up for many years, I've covered health for a long time, and one of the things that is talked about the most is that experts have blamed the women. They've focused on the fact that women are older when they're giving birth. They may be obese, and that brings a variety of complications to the table. We are, as a society, less healthy. We have diabetes and other chronic health conditions, and all of those things increase the risks for women when they are getting pregnant. And to be sure, those things are risk factors. They are contributing to how much harm is occurring to women who are giving birth. But those factors are in place in places like the United Kingdom. And women there are suffering harms at a fraction of the rate that they are in the United States. And one of the factors that is starting to get increasing attention within the medical community is the care that is being provided by medical professionals, and in particular, in the hospitals where women are going to give birth.
I want to get into more of the data, but I also want to make sure that we put a human face on this and get to some of those risk factors in the process. You share several heartbreaking stories in your reporting that show how things can go wrong. One was Allie Lowry from Ohio. Can you share her story with us?
Sure. So Allie Lowry was a first-time mom. She also happened to be a labor and delivery nurse. And so she had witnessed and helped many other women give birth. But this was finally going to be a child of her own. And she delivered at her own community hospital. And in her case, she started passing out shortly after getting back to her room after what seemed to be a pretty routine cesarean section delivery. And over the course of many hours, her blood pressure was plummeting. And no one was looking for her hemorrhaging. And it later turned out that she had been bleeding internally for quite some time and was in very bad shape by the time that they ultimately took her in and did some exploratory surgery. In her case, she nearly died because by the time she was transferred to another hospital, her hospital had run out of blood to even give her, to keep her alive. And in the end, this other hospital was able to find the source of the bleeding. But she was in such bad shape, they had to perform a hysterectomy to save her life, which meant she could not bear any more children going forward.
We're talking with Allison Young right now. She's an investigative reporter for USA Today, and we're talking about a very in-depth and comprehensive piece of Allison's about maternal death in the United States. And so that story of Allie Lowry, she was hemorrhaging and losing massive amounts of blood. The other, it seems, very common complication is high blood pressure and leading to stroke and sometimes death. Are those the two main issues that you came across?
Yes. So two of the leading preventable causes of maternal death and serious injuries are hemorrhage, the excessive bleeding after childbirth, and severe blood pressure conditions. Preeclampsia is one of them. And in both of those cases, what experts have found is that women are suffering harms because providers may be in denial that something bad is happening and they're not recognizing it early. And then there are delays in treatments that by the time that this is occurring, it becomes much more difficult to save the woman's life. We featured the case of another woman named Yolanda Menchen, who there is a recognized danger level. If your blood pressure goes above it, you're supposed to get immediate treatment with some very specific blood pressure drugs that are generally given only intravenously. There can be a lack of recognition that pregnant women's bodies react to blood pressures in ways that are far more dangerous than someone who's not pregnant. And what we found, and we got data from specific hospitals around the country, is that high percentages of women at some hospitals are not receiving these IV or other appropriate blood pressure treatments within the one-hour time frame after they have these dangerous blood pressures. And so we are giving a variety of tips for women. If they come to maternal.usatoday.com in our project, you can get tips for how you can check out your hospital and ask questions, but also some of the warning signs and questions to ask if you're looking out for your own care or the care of a loved one.
So there are protocols, recognized protocols, for treating these conditions before they become either grievously harmful or fatal. How many hospitals are voluntarily agreeing with those and following those?
That is the huge question. One of the things I think that is most surprising is it's impossible to know. There are no requirements that hospitals follow these recognized best practices. There is a movement by a national group called the AIM program that has put forth safety bundles that they've called for all maternity hospitals to adopt. And this isn't just some nonprofit group. This is a coalition of all of the leading medical societies, from the obstetricians to the midwives to nurses, have said these are evidence-based best practices that we should all be doing. But it's a voluntary area. And unfortunately, when I contacted 75 hospitals across the country to ask them some in-depth questions about are you or are you not doing these specific things, half of them would not even answer our questions.
It seems that there are ways to know what hospitals are doing in other cases. For instance, I believe that Medicare has regulations in place that hospitals that receive funds have to publicize data and their procedures. Why is this not in place for conditions like this?
It's a really good question. There is, the federal government has a website called Hospital Compare where you can find out detailed information about infection control practices and, other sorts of quality measures for conditions that primarily involve the Medicare or the older population in our society. But similar data is not available to the public on complication rates when it comes to childbirth. What is the hemorrhage rate? How do they give timely treatment for severe blood pressure? There are a variety of those kinds of measures that hospitals may be collecting internally, but they do not generally share that information with the public.
And Allison, as we wrap up, I do want to offer a hopeful scenario. California has been a very noticeable exception to this trend of rising maternal mortality. What is California doing that could hopefully be duplicated in other states?
So California is a huge outlier in the sense that as maternal deaths and harms have been going up elsewhere, California has dramatically reduced their harm rate. And experts say that a major factor in that is that they are one of the leading states where these kinds of best practices have been implemented and adopted by hospitals.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for your work on this and for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Allison Young is an investigative reporter for USA Today. She talked with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson earlier today about the problem of maternal deaths in U.S. hospitals. Now, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we continue our interviews with candidates for governor. There are contested primaries for Republicans and Democrats. Today, we talked to Josh Pade. He's a Wisconsin native and an attorney. He's worked on several Democratic campaigns. He's running in the Democratic primary. Josh Pade, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us that elevator pitch, the length of an elevator ride, to tell someone why you're running for governor.
I'm running for governor because it's time for Wisconsin to have a fresh start, a new chapter in our politics, in our policy across the state. You know, I'm from Kenosha, Wisconsin. I grew up there, but I was fortunate enough to live and work across the entire state of Wisconsin. I lost my dad when I was young, tragically, and had to go to work, put off college, and I ended up working for a family grocery company and moved around the country. I lived in Marshfield for a while, worked in the Fox River Valley, worked in the La Crosse area, and lived in Stanley for a little bit. And then I'm a proud Blue Gold. I went to Eau Claire for college once my siblings were old enough and worked my way through law school and got involved with public service and really kind of focused on having good policies to help families that were like mine. I saw my mom as a single mom struggle to pay the bills, to get health care, all those things. So it's something I've been advocating for a long time. And year after year of seeing our politics just devolve into divisiveness and, you know, bad economics and bad policies, I decided to run to be a powerful voice for everyone struggling as underdogs to make it.
And you're running in a crowded Democratic field here, 8 candidates on the ballot, including yourself. How do you distinguish yourself from the other Democrats on this ballot?
You know, I mean, I'm proud to be standing with such, you know, great, talented people who love and care for Wisconsin. We've come a long way, and there's people from all walks of life who have been impacted negatively by I think policies or just stagnation of not moving forward. And my background, I've worked in the public and the private sector, and I'm really truly bringing a fresh start to Wisconsin. And I think that's my uniqueness is that, you know, we can take a break from the past and really go forward in a way that brings people together, energizes Democrats, brings in independents, and says, what is our vision for Wisconsin to look like in the next 10, 20 years?
Now, you're hoping to win the primary and take on Governor Walker. He's making the case that what he's done in Wisconsin is working. Unemployment in particular, very low. What do you say about the state of the economy in Wisconsin and why you think the state needs to change?
I think the state of the economy is that people are working a lot for less money. And what I'm running on is to bring high-paying jobs to Wisconsinites, to give people more money, because if they save on things like healthcare, they'll have more money to spend on other things, to save for college, do things like that. And, you know, nationally, unemployment is down. We had a good quarter in the economy, but it's disjointed. The few people are doing very well, but a lot of people are still struggling, and they're working more for less wages. And we need to work on a set of policies that will bring wages up and make life more affordable for people.
So what kind of policies specifically would you do to try to raise wages in the state?
A couple things. So we do need to raise the minimum wage. I think that's a baseline, raising the floor for what people make. Do it in a smart way. Have a good schedule for how it gets implemented, because we haven't had a minimum wage increase in a while. So you want to bring that in a responsible way that doesn't shock businesses or communities, but also think outside the box a little bit. Start rethinking about things. You know, I've been focusing on entrepreneurship and bringing in high-paying new economy jobs across the country. Technology is changing the way we live our lives, and those areas are high-paying jobs. And we can bring those, we can grow those here in Wisconsin. We have great university, great talent, and unfortunately, a lot of that talent is going to other cities. And I think if we focus on a way of keeping those jobs here, focusing on investing in those type of businesses and entrepreneurship, Wisconsin's last in the country in new business growth. And I actually went to the foundation that did that study and said, "How do we fix that?" And it's a comprehensive plan. Some of the proposals are more conservative, some are more liberal, but it brings together all the different forces to grow entrepreneurship here in Wisconsin.
Talking to Josh Pate about his campaign in the Democratic primary for governor. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Staying with economic issues, all the Democratic candidates have been weighing in one way or another on the Foxconn factory and the state's incentive package there. What was your view on that deal? And as governor, how would you handle it?
So Foxconn for me was a little personal. You know, growing up in Kenosha and, you know, seeing families, kids I was playing Little League with, and watching their families, their parents lose their jobs as factory after factory closed, watching as we bailed out Chrysler and, you know, General Motors in Janesville and seeing those factories close, and our politicians basically stay silent while that happens, I was disheartened. And I had a little bit of hope by the fact that we could bring manufacturing back to that area. And, you know, particularly you look at Racine, which is still struggling to join the economic recovery. It provided a level of hope, but then you saw the price tag and the lack of accountability in that deal. And it's not what I would have done, in the sense that spending all that money, there's no guarantee that a subsidy is going to, how much subsidies are going to be for $30,000 a year jobs versus the median, which is the 54, I believe. And there's no like strong controls on transparency for that. I think going forward, the best way to work with that is say, how can we turn this into an opportunity with smart policies, common sense. And I think the best way to do that is, one, continue to put pressure on Foxconn to move forward in a transparent way on what the salaries for those jobs are going to be, put pressure on them to protect the environment, to hold them fast to what they've committed, and maybe even actually we can push them to commit to more, and we can join partners with the other states in the Great Lakes Compact, particularly on the water. And ultimately, how do we see this as a loss leader? How do we bring in other industries to grow around Foxconn, around the state of Wisconsin, and how do we focus on bringing the dividend of Foxconn to that stays in Wisconsin and grows businesses here? You know, as an economic development plan, we should focus more on growing entrepreneurship and growing businesses here in Wisconsin, because that's the best return on investment we'll ever get from a dollar of economic development.
Some Democratic candidates for governor have said they would try to reverse the Foxconn deal one way or another. It sounds like that's not what you would push for.
I just don't think that's the best way forward. I as much as I would love to be been in that discussion on day one when the Foxconn discussions were happening, we're coming into this, you know, months later, you know, walls are going up, dirt's being dug, to go back and try to renegotiate a contract or pull terms out, or, you know, or just flatly rip it up and then watch the deal go away, I don't think is necessarily the best way forward. But accountability is so important.
Then what would your priorities be, shifting gears here, on education?
So we have to do a couple things in education. One is fix the funding formula. You know, right now, zip code is the determining factor in education, and education is the ultimate anti-poverty program you could have. And unfortunately for too many people, the lack of quality education gets people further back right at the start of their lives. So fixing the funding formula so that it's based on student need, doing it in a way that we can, you know, not have such a burden on property owners, because that's ultimately the cuts in education have been hurting property owners as well as students, and focusing on having a rigorous curriculum, having high-paid teachers, encourage people when they go into college to want to become teachers, focusing on making sure that good teachers are put into the right places, because too often teachers aren't just teaching education. They're helping students deal with a lot of problems that they're bringing in from outside of school. And I've been on the trail of saying, you know, education reform doesn't end at the school walls. And that's true. We need to invest in our communities and make sure that the communities are set up for a child's success before they even start kindergarten.
And how about Wisconsin's current commitment to voucher funding for private schools?
So all the evidence shows that the voucher fund voucher program has not worked. The students at graduation are, you know, don't have a larger propensity of going to graduating from college or not based on the voucher program. And what often happens is you have a lot of school districts that, you know, people are paying money to fund a voucher program, but their kids aren't available to go to a voucher program school. I think we should focus public money on public education. And, you know, how that gets, you know, the facility of what the school looks like can be different, but the voucher program just doesn't work as is and should be phased out.
We're talking to Josh Pate about his campaign for governor in the Democratic primary, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for the candidate? Do you want to know where he stands on a particular issue? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Josh Pate is with us. We're talking about his campaign in the Democratic primary for governor of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Josh Pate about his candidacy? Do you want to know where he stands on a particular issue? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We've talked some about education in the primary school or the primary level. How about higher education?
I spent my first year of college at the University of Wisconsin, Wood County, the two-year college there, and then eventually went to Eau Claire. And the value of a two-year college is so incredible. For me, it was the only way. I wouldn't be here today if I wasn't able to get that first year of college done in an affordable way. So ensuring that we have affordable two-year in trade school is so important to me. I'd like to see us have the goal of tuition-free because tuition is only one part of the cost of education, but that's a push. The second thing is making sure that people that graduate from college don't have loads of debt. Law school was incredibly expensive for me. I graduated with a mortgage, and giving people the power to refinance their loans or to get jobs that allow them to pay their loans off is very important, and we need to make the UW system the pride that it is.
Turning to roads, this has been a controversial issue, how we fund road maintenance and development in Wisconsin. Would you be open to some kind of increase in user fees, gas tax, tolls?
Absolutely. I've been quoting a study, I think the American Society of Civil Engineers does their infrastructure report card, and they say that Wisconsin drivers pay on average $676 a year in repairs on their cars due to our bad roads. For me, that's tax we're already paying to have bad roads. So if we look at, you know, put everything on the table, understand what's the best sustainable path to use our roads as utilities, have a wide user base, do it in a way that's easy on families, but also has sustainable funding. You know, families will save money because they're not spending money for, you know, tire axle repairs.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Oconomowoc. Chris, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Chris?
I wanted to bring up the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund, whether or not the candidate would be in support of refunding that in the next budget.
Chris, thanks.
Sorry, what was that?
The Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund?
Oh, yes. I am in favor of refunding that. And, you know, we need to look at the budget in a way that resets our priorities and understanding that the, you know, Wisconsin has a lot of values and a lot of pride that we used to set the standard for in America, and our budget has gotten completely away from what represents Wisconsin values. And starting, you know, in my first budget, bringing back the focus on the right priorities is my goal.
Chris, thanks for the call. Lydia is with us next in Manitowoc. Lydia, hi.
Hi. I wanted to know what he's going to do about global warming, and if he's going to be bringing in some alternative powers to the state, and I'll take my answer up the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Lydia. The environmental protection is very important to me. I lost my mother when I was younger to lung cancer, and she was not a smoker. And when we look at the overall cost of coal sourced electricity, it ranges from about 14 cents to 35 cents per kilowatt hours in public health that we spend for lung cancer, heart disease, all the effects of having dirty electricity. And then that doesn't even get into the effects of global warming. You know, we're dealing with droughts, we're dealing with fires across the United States, and we need a full scope plan. And Wisconsin can be a leader in what the new energy revolution looks like. And if we get ahead of that, then we are going to bring innovation and money and investment here to Wisconsin. So we've got a plan to make Wisconsin 100% renewable by 2050 or sooner, with a target of 2035 for renewable electricity. I also want to look into things like cogen and even trigen facilities for biomass. So I actually talked to some people at Toyota that are doing this in Southern California. They have a new hydrogen-powered semi-truck. And part of the ways they create the hydrogen is by using fuel created from the methane emissions from manure. And they can convert that into hydrogen power and use that. So I told them, I said, well, I know a place where we have a lot of cow manure. And we could, you know, get rid of the runoff that's going into our waters, give a new revenue stream to our farmers, get rid of methane emissions and reduce carbon emissions, and invest to make sure that alternative vehicles today are the mainstream vehicles of tomorrow.
Lydia, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to candidate Josh Pade. He's running for governor in the contested Democratic primary. Back to your calls now. Mike is on the line in Ashland. Mike, hello.
Hey, thanks for having my call. Yeah, I would like to ask a question of how would you improve relations between tribal nations and improve their, you know, gaming packs, social welfare, IHS. I'll take your answer out there. Thanks.
Mike, thanks. So relations between the state and tribal governments within the borders.
Absolutely. We have to be good neighbors to our first citizens, the Native Americans. And growing up, you know, living all over, I've, you know, had the opportunity to visit and be a part of our different Native American cultures. And I was up at the Waters Life Forum earlier, about a month and a half ago, and just talking about how we can't neglect those communities, and too often they get left behind, whether it's the holding our mining accountable for the damage they're doing to those properties, or understanding their property rights and how valuable that is, that, you know, they are citizens too, and they have valuable property rights, and they can't just have their land taken for eminent domain for private companies. So going forward with a position of respect is the first thing you need to do as governor, and then all the policies that follow will fall into place in the right way.
Thanks for calling in. Jennifer is with us now in Brookfield. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment on the guest comment on debt and student loan debt, and how graduates need to keep in mind to get jobs that pay for the debt. And I was wondering if there's a message to young people, but especially parents, that taking out student loans is not necessary. And if there's anything you can do in terms of a message or in terms of policy for encouraging students to not take out loans and have that economic power to do other things and not towards loans.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. You know, going to college is about learning to not just the subject matter you learn, but how to be an adult in life. And, you know, it's too easy. You walk into a financial aid office and you say, I need money. And they give you a piece of paper and you sign out a loan, or a parent can go in there and sign out a loan. And there's no sort of layout of what that means, or understanding what you're going to go into as far as a career, and what loan you're taking out, how does that fit into what you want to become? You know, if you take out a huge loan to become, you know, something that's not going to generally have a large salary, but it's something you love and want to work in, understanding what those costs are. We should be working with students right away the day they go in and ask for money, that it's, you're not just asking for a loan, you're asking for a commitment, and teaching people early on how to function when work with debt, because too many people graduate and they don't know how to handle debt. And I think that's a big part of the reason why we have this massive debt crisis in the country, with two people with not just student loans, but credit cards as well.
Jennifer, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go to Rose now in Menominee Falls. Rose, welcome to the show.
Hi there. I want to tell Josh, I met him on Friday at the forum for the governor's candidates, and all I want to say is I hope, if you do not succeed in this particular race, I hope you'll stay in and work in politics, because I think you've got some great ideas. And I think part of your message is we need to, you know, move forward and think of new and creative ways to run this state. And I really like what you're saying.
Rose, thanks for that call. You want to respond, Josh?
Thanks. Thank you, Rose, so much. You know, I'm not related to Rose. but I appreciate the comment. And I am in this to help my state and be a citizen servant. And regardless of, you know, I hope I win the primary, because I think we have some big decisions to make in 2018. But win or lose, I'm committed to working and helping my state.
And currently, before we wrap up, you could end up with a Democratic governor, perhaps you, and Republicans controlling one or both chambers of the legislature. How would you see yourself in that scenario working across the aisle?
That's, you know, one thing that I, the advantage I've had from working on Capitol Hill, even as a very low level person, is just working with a lot of people that have very different views, come from very different walks of life. And, you know, I have my beliefs and what I believe, but I approach this with the principle that even like the Republicans want to take our state forward and have big goals. They just have different ways of getting there. And I think if we set a common goal and don't demonize each other, that we can work towards tackling these huge challenges we have.
Briefly, is there one issue that pops to mind where you could see really easy pickings for bipartisanship?
So I've been a huge proponent of occupational licensing reform. It's kind of a very nerdy subject, and Governor Walker just recently signed a bill that does some reform on occupational licensing. But even, you know, the Obama administration was pushing for states to reform their occupational licensing because it actually furthers income inequality when we have very complicated rules for people to start their own businesses, which is whether it's you want to go into the salon business or you want to be a massage therapist. All these different rules and complicated are just blocking people from getting to do their dream.
We'll leave it there for now. Josh Paid, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Josh Paid is running for governor as a Democrat. Businesswoman and former state lawmaker Kelda Royce, who's also running for governor as a Democrat, joins us at this time tomorrow. Profiles of all of the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor can be found at WPR.org/governor. And between now and the August 14th primary, we've invited candidates in contested primaries to join us for interviews on Central Time in the Morning Show. Find all of those interviews at WisconsinVote.org.